Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today we're going to debrief on our actual play of Legendary Skull Mountain. In case you missed it, last weekend we streamed over 12 hours of live D&D. So today we're going to share our post-mortem of what worked, what didn't, and what surprised everybody who watched. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the chat today, everyone, I'll remind you that, as always, at the end of the show will be our after-party chat. That is a live video chat, usually hosted by Dan and I, but not me today, I'm afraid. I will be wandering off down to the lovely Providence and Islands. What did they call it again? Okay, anyway. Anyway, if you want to join Dan for the after-party chat, you can do so by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms and join at any tier. You'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that all set up during the show. And at the end of the show, about 10 minutes or after or so, Dan will be there to host our live video chat.
Absolutely. And in addition to me, Paul, they'll also get to enjoy the thoughts of our top brain trust patrons, such as our aide-de-camp Baquius, who's checking in right now, that we are, in fact, live on YouTube and Twitch. So thanks for that. As well as other patrons, so we'll look forward to that. So, Skull Mountain. So I'm so glad, first of all, that we got to go back and do an all weekend long actual play with our best friends that we just adore. We did do that 7 years ago, and we kind of thought that was going to be a routine thing until COVID happened the next year and really threw a massive monkey wrench into our grandiose plans that we had. So yeah. This version of Skull Mountain was written by, I believe, Jeff Sparks and from published by Faster Monkey Games in 2010. Lovely, lovely custom art there. And of course, if you aren't familiar with the oldest of old school games, this is a encounter area that's inspired by a single brief image in the original basic D&D set all the way back in 1977 in the Eric Holmes basic D&D set. Have just had this single sample cross-section of levels and this one very evocative illustration. There is no other text. There's no other explanations. There's no sample encounter areas. This is the D&D rule set I personally got initially and grew up with. And like many other people in my generation, I have been obsessed with this for these many years. And the fact that I rolled into Paul's place and he said, "Hey, surprise, you're playing Skull Mountain," was just mind-blowing.
I've wanted to run this one for a while. This was published back in 2010, and I definitely stole most of it for my campaign around that time period. Bits and pieces, I actually chopped it in half. I had the first, what we see here, actually here, I'm going to give you a side-by-side, Dan. This is on the left, the original Stone Mountain from Holmes. And then on the right, you have the version of that appears in Skull Mountain by Jeff Sparks. Pretty much the same thing. Pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, pretty close. Topologically, anyway. Pretty much. I agree.
Very close. And obviously was clearly inspired by that. I mean, Jeff Sparks talks about it in the text. He dedicates the module itself to Eric Holmes. So. clearly, it's a love letter to this edition and this picture. So yeah, I had chopped it in half. I think I used like the first and second levels in one part of my campaign, and then later stole the lower levels for a different part of the campaign. But they were all present. So I've run it before, but not as a whole. And I was excited to run it for you. Here, I'm going to zoom back in here. Because I knew you would know this picture, which of course in the original is just labeled Stone Mountain, not Skull Mountain, though you can clearly see the kind of skull face carved into the mountain there.
The great stone skull is labeled there as a prominent starting feature. And the other thing that I told Paul off camera last weekend is that the extra mind-blowing part is that as busy as I am, occasionally I need a little bit of recreation. And I had just been looking at this within the week. And it is true. I had no idea what Paul was going to run. Completely coincidentally, I had actually been looking at this within the week and was actually working again on my heartbreaker version of Skull Mountain myself, merely days before I landed at Paul's place. And then he rolls out, we're going to run this version. And that was one of those really weird universe bending moments of like, that is real wacky, that I literally had this up in a window on my desktop when I put it to sleep before I traveled to Paul's place.
Yeah, so you can still get this on DriveThruRPG. You can find the PDF for I think all of $2. So I mean, you should go check it out. It's a great module. It's not perfect, of course, nothing is, and we'll point out some critiques of it as we go here, but it is really good, and I highly recommend it. Super fun. I've enjoyed both times I've run it now, and would run it again. Would run it again, and it doesn't. It's huge, honestly. The in the introduction, the author talks about like probably the party will have to do multiple forays into the level, and he talks about like here's probably a good spot for the first breaking point where maybe the party will have a reason to return to town and rest. I think he way underestimates it. Frankly, we did 12 hours of this. And I had to vastly edit the end. I chopped out huge sections of the very ending to get us to a climax before everybody had to return home. So there's a lot of content in here, is my point. It's good stuff.
I think looking at the map as spoilers. If anybody's watching this and they didn't have a chance yet to watch the live stream, there's going to be some spoilers in this particular hour. So if you feel like you are going to watch some or all that, maybe watch that first and then come back to our postmortem. So here, start the spoilers. We did make it down to what in the original version here is the seventh level. We didn't make it to the domed city. So because of time, I think we got to the beach of the underground lake that's down on the lowest level. I think we maybe saw the lights of the domed city. We didn't get over the water. And there was a climactic fight on the shores of the underground lake is the furthest that we got, I believe.
For what it's worth, I actually cut the sixth level entirely. I connected 5 to 7 for you. And yes, there's a whole part on the seventh level where you have to cross a lake to get to the Dome City. The whole Dome City is included in here. The final climactic end fight with the big bad at the end happens inside the central dome. I moved it to the shores of the lake because I was just like, nope, we do not have time for what was frankly, you know, besides just the sixth level, in the Dome City, I've got just pages of maps of the internals of the domes, multiple levels, many, many areas. And like, nope, just don't have time for any of that. Just cut it all and just moved everything to the shore of the lake just so that you could get that final end fight before everybody has to get on the bus home. So yeah, there's a lot more content. Also, you missed level 4B. I'll point that out. You totally bypassed level 4B. Yes. Never saw it.
Yes.
And
Paul told us afterwards that's the point, if you were watching the show, that's the point where there is a pit that leads to a tunnel, and there's two levels, and we were fiddling with one that dropped oil, and we lit the fire, we lit it on fire. And we were guessing that there might be the other one might be activating a pit trap or something like that. We decided to avoid it, and I guess that's the tunnel that does lead to 4B, is what we were told afterwards.
Yep. And there was an entry to 4B from the third level also, which you did not find. In fact, the third level, right? You breezed through. There was some of my favorite set pieces are in the third level. But you found the secret door that led to the ladder down to 4A and you just immediately took it, which is great. Great. Good play.
Great. Great, great. Great. Excellent.
By the way, that's in the original module. So again, here we go. Going to jump into spoilers. the hook that the priority is given is that the local lord's son has been kidnapped and you're going to go try to find him. In the original, the way it's written, he is in level 4A right in that room where that secret door with the ladder down is. And that's where it suggests maybe you want to break for the first time and return to town. Okay. And I think that you guys returned to town, I don't know, once or twice before even getting that far.
Yeah.
Second level, honestly, that second level is so nasty. And both times I've run it, it has really wrecked the party. And the party has had to make multiple attempts to get through it.
It's an interesting opportunity to reflect on the question that sometimes comes up. So the second level, having gone through it, and I could immediately kind of recognize it's a mazy labyrinth of a bunch of traps, and which is, you know, a classic D&D element from the earliest days. And you could reflect on the question is, are a bunch of traps, quote unquote, fun to play through? Not that I think that fun is canonically a necessary element in your fantasy play. But I found it an interesting challenge. I was, happy that I could recognize certain patterns, that as soon as I fell into one pit with a dead end beyond, I could go, okay, gang, probably every time we find a pit with our pole from now on, there's probably just a dead end past it. We don't need to fight past it. We can go someplace else. That turned out to be correct. So it was an interesting opportunity to kind of see some patterns and kind of guess what would be productive and wasn't. So I actually didn't mind that myself.
You know, man, I should have clipped some of the maps to put up here. Maybe I'll try to do that while we're talking. Stop me if I become too distracted trying to do this.
I mean, Paul, I have mine. So I have mine right here. So I think this will help everybody if I just hold this up right here and see what we were dealing with on level two with the labyrinths and the maps. Yeah. And, you know, this part here is, I have an arrow.
We had this exact moment in the actual play for folks who didn't notice, where Dan said, oh, do you want to, do you want to look at my map? And I was like, no, absolutely not. I will get so distracted by, the number of inaccuracies. it will be bad.
I was holding that upside down and I couldn't tell. I'm so sorry, everybody. It should be like, this. This is what it should be. Assuming north is up, then it's, I think it should be like this, I believe. But it got us through. It got us through. And yeah, and it's yeah. funny oh, because yeah, no, no. when I am mapping, usually someone leans over, like the DM or somebody leans over and goes, I think you're off by 10 feet there. And I'm like, the goal here is live. The goal here is to not get lost, not get cut off by a wandering monster and be able to get out. So I'm not worried about 10 feet here or there, as long as I can just get from point A to point B, which we ultimately successfully did.
And you did great, right? And your map was super helpful. There were definitely moments where you correctly identified, like, oh, that's probably a false door because there's no way there's space for a room behind it, right? So that was great. Here we go. I'm going to refresh here. And there it is. Wow. There it is. That is the actual map of that section. Mm. So here's the fun part. And I want to talk about like why this is fun to DM this level. So if you can see on the right center edge of the map is the stairs down where the players come in. All as a DM, I have the following. One is the question of like, are the enemies aware of the players? And in our case, Dan, the enemies were highly aware of the players constantly throughout your exploration. And maybe you have some insights into why that might be. You can push back if you feel like I was misplaying that. But I think that they were well within their rights of knowing exactly where you were all the time.
So I think that Paul might be possibly implying that in particular, my character of Scotty McCartan, I think somewhere on social media later I put this is when we're trying to sneak into Skull Mountain the first time past the defenders, and I said it's a loud kind of quiet. So when there's a giant statue blocking the corridor, Scotty, like, give me the giant strength spell and I just push it wherever I'm with a giant screeching roaring sound, push that, hacking through doors, breaking the furniture was a relatively common occurrence. And I think Paul was leaning on that as a rationale for why everybody knew where Scotty was leading the party.
Yes. Scotty shouted everything that he ever said. He shoved over any piece of stonework he could find. He opened doors with his axe. And once it was discovered that there was dangerous traps, he proceeded to use the classic methodology of tapping with a 10-foot pole, which is a great way to find traps, but also a great way to announce your location to everyone around.
Interesting. Hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. So this is a fun bit of tactical play for the DM. I want to point that out, that this level is super fun to DM, because here's what I have on my end. I have a bunch of level one thieves. Not a lot of them. They're terrible. My players are playing sixth level characters. I am way outclassed. There's no way I'm going to survive. And then I have their leader, who is a very intelligent character. In the text, he's written as a cleric thief. I adapted him into a magic user thief for OED so that, you know, we wouldn't have that problem of the no clerics in our game. But nevertheless, he's got the ability to turn invisible. He's got a magic weapon, magic armor. He's got a bunch of spells. He is several interesting magic items, including the mask, which causes fear. Right. He is a great, interesting character to play. But again, even though he's pretty buff, in a one-on-one fight, surrounded by a party of six-level characters, he's going to go down, right? That happens anytime. I think you have a reasonably powerful boss and then a whole party. The action economy is just against you. You're gonna suffer.
Agreed.
So here's what I had. And part of this is the tactics that the module encourages you to do, is that the thieves super know the layout of this labyrinth, right? This is their main defense of keeping people out of their hideout. So their goal is to just stay just ahead of the party and draw them into as many traps as possible to try and whittle down their resources. Meanwhile, the leader is, if he's aware of the party, and again, like it, in the text, it says he's down on level 4, but if he hears noises, he will come up to investigate and help the defense. So of course, he heard lots of noises, lots of crashing. He comes up invisible and is now stalking around the tunnels as well, watching, keeping an eye on the party and trying to cause them problems, and then attack them in the most advantageous point that he possibly can. And that's just super fun to roleplay that. So the players come down the stairs. If they just turn left, they're going to find the big interesting chamber at area 2 and a possible way down at area 3. It's all right there. In fact, the most efficient play here is to just ignore everything, turn left, and you're fine. You're done. No, the party did not do that. Because of course I had a couple guys standing at the bottom of the stairs to take a couple pot shots at the players and then run to the right. And of course the players gave chase. And now the game's on, because now I'm doing things like jumping over pits and taking pot shots and trying to draw them into the pit traps. And stalking around with the, I don't know if you realize this, Dan, but all the way on the left side, that giant north-south passageway, that's the passageway that has an incline with a boulder at the area marked B. Behind a door. So if the door gets open, the boulder comes rolling down. My invisible thief was standing there watching you come up the hallway, waiting for the perfect moment to open the door.
Got it. Oh. Right. Oh. Yeah. Oh. Okay. Yeah.
So that wasn't what I expected. He intentionally triggered that trap on you to try and screw you up.
Okay. Well done. Well done. And I will say, like, on the issue of one boss against a party, like, we were really felt like we were in super trouble, because he hit us with that fear mask. Majority of us failed saves and ran, and then he had Max's wizard Aragrast pinned alone, and I felt like we were in an enormous, and we dropped all of our main magic weapons from the fear, so I felt that we were in an enormous amount of trouble, because he'd managed to make a one-on-one fight with our wizard, and I was really worried about losing one or more characters at that point.
That was a nice moment. Unfortunately, by that point, you had also eradicated all of his troops, so it was just him, right? So by that point, right, you guys go running, and I had a moment of like, oh, geez, what does he do now? What's his tactic at this point? And I was like, definitely
a lesson for you kids out there.
Yeah. So that was a lot of fun for me, honestly. I enjoyed that. You can see Dan down there is the little hole down to level 3 through the area of darkness that you ultimately chose, and then in the bottom left corner is the secret passage that with the nice pleasant staircase at least to area 3 that you never found until later.
Right. It's an interesting homage in that area too, that there's a giant demon mouth with a big black hole of blackness, which obviously in while we were playing, I kind of referenced, eek, I still don't like that.
It's delightful,
I don't know why
magical,
it is in my brain.
Yeah, there's magical darkness on the other side, so, and there's magical silence on the other side. So if you go pushing through, there's just, it's just nothing. It's just empty space and terrifying. I love that.
Of course,
this is part of
the... We all think of the Green Devil Mask in Tomb of Horrors, which is a sphere of annihilation, which actually does automatically no save destroy anything that passes through the mouth. So there is this extra level of terror for old school D&Ders that we have to possibly interact with it. And like, and I said in the stream of like, this is either instant death or it's the only way forward. It's one of those two. So what are we going to do about that?
Set pieces like this and the giant internal cavern with the staircase that winds around the stalactite were reasons that I wanted to play with no dark vision. I was like, this is going to be much more fun with no dark vision.
I see. Now, will say, that makes so much sense. I will say that, number one, we said after the stream that a point of clarification that could have been used is how are the thieves in the labyrinth seeing? And I think the answer was that should have been described as torches everywhere. If I'm not misremembering. And the other thing is, at least in most classic D&D rules, the magical permanent darkness foils infravision as well. It could have been played that way, but I'm glad we tried it your way throughout.
Yeah, I liked it more the other way. I was curious to see if I was going to see anybody try to combat these things with interesting uses of light and darkness spells. Those never came up, but I thought that would have been fun. And yes, the second level I should have described as having torches everywhere, because it's inhabited by a bunch of humans, right? Like,
right.
It's gotta be torches everywhere. That's the only answer.
Right.
You know, and then ultimately also, I think I was just curious. Like, I've heard of people playing without dark vision, and I thought I would like to see what that's like. I'm curious what that's like.
I approve, and
I think I still screwed it up because I think I got backwards I got incorrect the radius of light. I think I was being over generous with the lantern extending 60 feet when it probably only should have gone 30.
I said that to the players and didn't say it to you.
Oh, thanks, Dan. Jeez. I will say, as when DM, I super enjoyed it, and I will play more games with no dark vision. I think that's going to be on my list to experiment with more, because you know, I know it's a little contrary to what we're used to, but I enjoy the effect quite a bit. It might take me some time, some practice to get used to it, because I'll probably...
Yes, that's a good observation. That's a good... You know, I think that's well thought out. I support continued experimentation like that. There was a game, I don't know, a year or two ago now, that I ran with you as a player, where I had all the combat and saves be roll low on the D20. And frankly, I there's a bunch of reasons why I actually prefer that, and I'm more convinced of that over time, but... kind of see whether players would swing that way. And I think that was a good experimentation for me. So that's those are all good ideas. Let me make a point. There's some really great questions in the chat, but I'm going to prioritize my... I'm going to put the moment
your
right
show, Dan.
My...
I think it's only fair.
Partly it is. So, you know, back in the day when this was published, so I never read this. I never read Spark's version of Skull Mountain, and I was aware of it when it came out in 2010. I've always been interested in the suggestive element in the Holmes rules. I've occasionally tweaked and tuned a version myself and used some ideas from it in my own campaign. And what I did do at the time is I read some reviews of it, and you know, you're Paul, you're commenting on how big it is. But one of the comments I think from several reviews, which I was very quick to believe, is that it's actually arguably not big enough. Is that some people were actually surprised by how relatively small some of the levels are. I think level one only has about two rooms. The stairs go up to the eyes level. there's just the two rooms for the eyes, unless we were missing some kind of bunch of secret chambers or something like that. And I think super, super old school players would expect. So we, you know, we ran through a lot of the content in, you know, in one weekend. And of course, at the very outset of Dungeons and Dragons, the basic play expectation was that the DM, their entire campaign setting was one single mega dungeon, and potentially you could have multiple adventures in any particular level, and potentially you could play in that one dungeon for maybe like a year or two or three or four maybe. And so I specifically avoided ever reading this version because I didn't want it to contaminate the ideas that I might have had for my own version, as a matter of fact. So I was certainly coming into this certainly fresh. So just in case some people aren't aware of what the extent might have been at the time, I'll remind everybody that when the first basic set came out from Eric Holmes, there weren't any pre-made adventures. So Keep on the Borderlands hadn't been written yet. In Search of the Unknown hadn't been written yet. And what the very first box set came out with was a rule book. And then the Dungeons and Dragons Geomorphs product that had a bunch of pages with pre-made dungeons drawn by Gary Gygax that you could use or tweak or tune or cut up if you want to. And so I have like a couple of examples of what that design expectation might be like in the featured images, Paul. If you go to the one with the orange dot, just to, what in my head. So this would be like Gary's basic dungeons. This is the first page of the basic dungeons geomorph that this basic set came from. And I'm pretty sure, if I recall correctly, the original rule said specifically, like, if you want to flesh out this dungeon, use the enclosed geomorphs. I'm not putting my thumb on the right page here. If I recall correctly, it said, you know, use the geomorphs to map out what the specific levels look like. So this would be one single page, incredibly intricate. You know, looks like a lot like Gary's earliest adventures for like Barrier Peaks or the Hill Giant Chief adventure kind of looks like this. So some of us would be expecting a single level to be however many rooms are here, 40 or 50 or 60 rooms. And then maybe we can just glance at the image with the yellow dot on it, which would be the second product, which was the Caves and Caverns version. So when you get down to levels 5, 6, 7, if someone in the early days was doing this, just grab that Geomorphs product, plop it down. This is kind of what the basic expectation would be for the caverns level, something like that. So some of us might actually have expected even more areas that might take you years to get through compared to this 2010 version.
I understand that critique, absolutely, because let me show you some more. I've been snipping some of the maps so I can put them up here. Hopefully they'll fit. Hopefully they'll fit the window right. Apologies. a little crop. That's what I thought. But this is the entirety of level one, minus a little bit of tunnel on the right side. That's it, right? There's the eyes in the central chamber and then the mouth and you know, a couple of rooms, and there you go. This is the entirety of level three.
Right? Yeah.
Five rooms, right? Yeah. Level. Right. I'll just zip through them. Here's level 4A. Here's level 4B.
Got it.
Not a lot of areas. Yeah. I agree that by expectation, you know, of what you see in this cross section.
Yeah.
You're expecting much, much more massive stuff. Now that said, the seventh level, man, that's pages upon pages in here about this. What's in the seventh level? Like, all those buildings are
yeah,
you know, they look just little tiny drawings in this, but they're filled out with many, many areas. Some of which are super fun too, which I'm kind of sad we didn't get to run. And some further set pieces in there that I have stolen for boss fights for breakfast in the past that we didn't get to. And that's one thing I'll say about this module. It's like just the richness of the set pieces. There are so many good set pieces in this. They just hit you with them again and again and again, which I think is wonderful. I understand the critique of it being.
Sorry, it's not even really a critique. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. For me, I wouldn't want more than this. This is exactly what I want. This is, and that's maybe my personal taste, because also, like, I love Dyson's mm-hmm. Delve, which describes itself mm-hmm. as a mini mega dungeon. For me, on the larger scale of what I want from big dungeons, that's about it. I don't want these enormous, the entire campaign, multiple years, mm-hmm. mega dungeon. Even Stone, like something like Stonehell, it's just too much, man. It's just too much for me. So these are perfect for me.
I get that. And before we go off this image, you know, I will say that when I have run, you know, brought in mega dungeons in my campaigns, there's a little bit of resistance or surprise from modern players. They're kind of surprised that it is taking multiple sessions to go through. It's not entirely overjoyed about that. And I'm thinking, you know, nowadays, if you are going to run a mega dungeon based campaign, you might need to say it up front. You might actually need to say the whole campaign is this one giant mega dungeon. You know, tell me that, you know, give me some buy-in if you're okay with that fundamentally. And as an old school player, whenever I looked at this particular side view image, my base level assumption, just looking at it, is that probably levels 1, 2, and 4A and 4B are probably a whole piece of paper, a whole filled piece of paper each. And that the third level would probably have to be two pieces of paper. I'm like, oh, the third level, that one's really big. I'm going to put two pieces of paper and have a really big level. Probably for third and seventh levels would be my assumption. So it was perfect, right? The extent of this version was perfect for our weekend, just like Dyson's Delve was perfect for our weekend. And I totally get that. And, you know, maybe gargantuan play it forever mega dungeons are going to be surprising for current players. You're right.
I mean, I'll push back a little bit on this was perfect for the weekend. We could have done two weekends on this. Easy.
Yeah.
Right. Like we did with Dyson's, right? We could have split it into a first half and second half. Absolutely. That would have worked. But yeah. Yeah. That said, I think there are, I don't know. There's some parts, especially of this, but the sixth level's not my favorite. So I was happy to cut it.
Okay.
So the sixth level is kind of a series. It's almost like a series, like where it's like just a straight line.
Yeah.
Interesting encounter. Which is fun, right? There's some interesting set pieces that you have to deal with, but it's very linear.
Yeah.
And it's a little weird, right? Because it starts to play with the idea of like you're deep underground and there's lava and stuff. So, yeah, it's a little strange.
And I'll say that the whole sensibility that you're going to have a linear series of like really interesting set pieces is very different. Also, it's just the labor of making a mega dungeon initially, like each room would be like one line, and there would also be a lot of mobility built into the geography. So players could, you know, go into level one or whatever and could go to like this series of rooms on the left or this series of rooms on the right, or this series of rooms forward ahead. And they'd all have some kind of little theme, but they'd actually have a lot of flexibility about where they went. And there wasn't, you know, quote unquote, a story about, you know, point A leads to point B to point leads to point C. So the effort and the attention that Sparks put into these set pieces certainly paid off for us. And that might not have been something you'd have time for in a gargantuan mega dungeon.
Cool. What else do you want to cover, Dan? We are, you know, there's a lot. There's a lot to pick apart here. So I'm happy to talk about whatever parts of it you want.
Okay, so let me throw up a question from William in the chat. He asked, that's not working. Okay. I apologize, viewers. So what William asked was, I still don't get the coin pooping room. And I agree with William. So there was a room, below the third, I worm down through a tunnel. I come out and there's five buckets that are labeled with the five different coin types that we had a really funny interaction about, because to me, it was really obvious what that was for. And none of the other players immediately picked up on that. It's the five coin types. So what was that about?
Interesting. I mean, in the text, it's just labeled as the counting room, and it's clearly the room where, like, level three is the base of operations of the thieves, right? So you kind of have two major factions going on here, right? You have the thieves, the haberdashers, who are occupying the upper levels, who originally were just bandits. You know, they maybe were, you know, have origin story of having arisen from a cult, but these days they're just a bandit gang. And then you have Cooper, their leader, who fell down the pit, right? He literally fell down, managed to survive that fall, encountered the Avatar, which is just a black dragon who is manipulating people and creatures into thinking that he's a god and trying to get, you know, things to serve him. The Avatar is now in the lowest levels, and he's got a bunch of lizard folk that he is that he uses as his main operatives. And you know, so Cooper falls. The story is Cooper falls down there, comes across this civilization, comes across the Avatar, and the Avatar basically convinces him, "Yep, I'm a god. You have to return to the old ways. You have to convert your bandit gang back to a cult to serve me." And Cooper's like, "I'm in. Let's do it." So the third level is kind of right. So the second level where you have this maze, it's the second level is just pure defense. Keep people out of our base. And the third level really is the base of operations for the bandits. And then anything below that, now you're getting into the Avatar's realm and the lizard folk. So that first room is called the counting room, and it's literally just where the bandits, all the loot that they've stolen, it's where they sort it.
Great.
That's it.
That makes sense. Okay, great.
You know, there's a list in there, right? Which I think you translated. There's a list of loot that they've acquired in the past. Mm-hmm. There's the weird counting thing. Now, I grant you, I think everyone has that take on the counting. Like it's described as, quote, a bench. You know, what's a bench for? It's for sitting on, right? There's a bench. It's got holes in it that are labeled and buckets under the holes. And it's hard to describe that without people immediately thinking, oh, it's a shitter. Like that makes sense. I would have that take as well. And it is funny if you haven't found the tunnel that you came in through before. If you've found that tunnel, in order to find it from this end, you got to crawl under that bench. And maybe people are like, ew, gross, it's going to be full of poop. Maybe. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but that's certainly part of it, right?
I mean, we've done that so many times in the past that it's like, yep, here's the point where I got to crawl naked through poop.
Yes. This is room one on level three, right? And I don't know. I love that you found the chute from the other end and came down it.
This is my pretty close.
Rooms three and four are delightful set pieces that you totally avoided, but I love them. There is a secret passage in room three. It was the other way down into the fourth level, which you did not find. Really, really great stuff in there. So anyway, that's cool. That's the coin pooping chamber, if you will, cool. AKA the counting room.
Got it. I said it on Discord, so I'm kind of thinking about like performance issues, so to speak. And I said it on Discord, but you know, I was leaning pretty hard on. I mean, I'm not like a method actor or anything like that, so I wasn't talking in voice on our breaks, but I was leaning pretty hard into embracing, you know, Scotty's character while we were playing. And some of our Max and Lauren said afterwards that they were, to begin with, Max said, "You're not going to be able to maintain that all weekend." And then 72 hours later, they were like, "I can't believe you maintained that all weekend." And I had the really weird experience that when we stopped, I had trouble going back to my normal diction. And so we ended Sunday afternoon, all Monday, Tuesday, my internal monologue before I would start speaking was in Scotty's slightly Yoda-esque diction. And I was, oh no, I've never had that experience before. I was like, I hope I didn't just break my diction. So that was kind of interesting. And here in New York, you know, we do have some of us doing some, you know, weekly improv jams at places and drop in improv stuff. So we're kind of getting an opportunity to think about our performances more in the last week or so. And, you know, I hope I didn't, you know, as a player, I hope I don't want to, I want to entertain people both at the table and elsewhere. And I don't want to steamroll people either. So I hope that I wasn't going too far or interrupting people too much. And you know, one interesting thing, and maybe this is semi-unique, but when I sit down as a player, there's some amount of people looking to me for, I guess, support, I guess I'll say it. And, you know, obviously, you and I are co-hosts of the channel, and some of the house rules we have at the table were actually written by me. So those are all factors. And it's an interesting point of tension that I very much want to support and help my other players, but I also want to give them agency. And I don't want it to just be the Dan show. And even if I'm playing the leader of the party, I don't want everybody's move to just be what Dan dictated. So it's an interesting point of tension. I'm like, you know, like there was a point near the end where we were running down a tunnel. We were chasing lizard men. We suspected there might be a trap. It turned out to be a big boulder trap. And, you know, we had our thieves on the far end. Our invisible thieves were clearly safe. And so Scotty went running down the tunnel to help the thieves. And then that prompted two of our other characters to run after him. And as a result, all three of us got hit by the giant boulder that came running through. And afterwards, I was kind of kicking myself of like, should I have told people to stay behind? Because I suspected it was dangerous. Scotty has the best armor class and the most hit points. So I'm happy to run into the danger zone if need be, have me get hit by the trap and keep other people safe. But as a meta performance issue, if I tell other people don't follow me, then they're out of the spotlight for a while, and maybe I'm taking some play experience away from them. So that was like one example of a point where I was really debating with myself about, should I keep other players safe? Or should I not do that because it's telling them to be inactive? And that's kind of it for me. That's kind of an interesting thing that I'm trying to juggle all the time, to give people opportunities to, you know, to get involved with their own decisions, but also not get their characters walloped.
it's interesting because this kind of came up for me in a slightly different way. I hear where you're coming from. And the funny thing is I'm reminded a little bit too of when I ran my first campaign, I played with a lot of people who were fairly new to D&D, new to the old school stuff. So, you know, all the tropes were, you know, they weren't uber familiar with it. Right. And I was playing with BJ, who was super used to all this stuff. And he just delighted in just bringing that into his character. Right. That just became his character. Was like, oh, I've been around. I'm the old grizzled veteran, and I'm going to train these youngins and how to do things right. Right. And that was, I mean, bringing it into the fiction is delightful. I think bringing it into the fiction is a great way to deal with that. On the other side, I was worried that when I saw you making what I considered mistakes, that the players were just going to be like, well, he knows what he's doing. Follow Dan. Dan is definitely right about this stuff. Yeah. Right. And so there was moments where I was like, especially with the noise thing, right? I was trying to give them a little more agency to be like, guys, Scotty's not, you know, not always right. He's not always doing being wise here. So maybe, you know, take that into consideration. I guess I'm kind of curious from your end, Dan. Like, were you just leaning into the character of Scotty and like tossing shit around like that? Or were you worried about the noise at all?
It's a synthesis. Like, I heard you saying that, like the thing that, so it was a synthesis of that's the character. I'm hoping to like entertain viewers a bit, and I want to aggro the enemies on my tank. So I was specifically trying to get traps, people, attacks. And like the very best time, that was one of my favorite times playing ever, was when you had all of the lizard men, all pig pile Scotty all at once. And I was delighted by that. The thought of him we even played with the miniatures, but just completely buried by a pile of enraged lizard men, and me keeping the rest of the team away from attacks for several rounds was really wonderful. So I was actually trying to aggravate. Now, I think as I speak about it, like maybe the lesson once again, which I keep falling down on, is provide more information. We had a great Star Frontiers game Friday night. So we've had some great gaming in the last week, and I got to run my Star Frontiers campaign for Max and Lauren and other friends Friday night, and that was one of the best sessions we ever had. And one of the things I was doing is I was giving more information. When the players might have been confused about some clue that they were interpreting, I just stepped in and said, "Just let me be very clear. This is the situation that you're dealing with." And so as Scotty, you know, like running down the tunnel, I think many of us keep running into this mistake of we want an interesting surprise. We want to come around to our turn and go, I have this particular trick that I can pull out that you didn't see that, you know, kind of works in a piece of fiction or a movie. But as a team challenge solving, maybe down the tunnel, I should have said, I think there's a trap that's going to wallop somebody. I'm probably safe. I'm gonna run down, and if something drops on me, I can definitely survive it. And then let everybody know what my intention is better. Maybe that was the main mistake that I was making, and then they can make an informed decision.
You know, maybe this is too subtle, but I feel like you could probably code that to some of the players by just running down the tunnel, yelling, "Scotty McTartan!" in a sort of Leroy Jenkins kind of way. Just kind of clue them into like, oh, that's what's happening, is it? I see.
I'll say, I'm really glad that people picked up on the Shining reference. I was super happy when I hacked through a door and said, it be the Scotty McTartan trio! That people got that where I was, what I was alluding to there was very satisfying.
I want to point out, like, because you mentioned the pig pile, which was hilarious for me as well, because I'm sitting there and I'm like, I knew it was a bad tactical choice on my end. I'm like, I have all these lizard folk, like having them all dump on top of Scotty, they will need natural 20s to hit him. It's just a bad tactical choice. But it was a really enjoyable scene. And I do think that as DM, we can also fall into this, like, I want to surprise them mentality. Or what I feel often tugging at me is this, like, oh, there's this interesting thing in the dungeon here. And the players, just by having just the right stat or just the right piece of equipment or whatnot, are just completely circumventing it.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, but now they're not going to get the fun of actually the challenge of what this thing is because they're completely circumventing the challenge just through some mistake. And what I often fall back on is I've reread a couple times recently, and I quoted him recently, is Jeff Rient's famous blog entry of How to Awesome Up Your Players. This is a slightly different piece of advice where he says in there, give your players the sun and make them fight for the moon. Like, it is okay for your players to occasionally just own the enemy. That's great. Let them do it. They can feel special for a moment, right? And then laugh at them as you roll them over with boulders or fire catapults at them or do other crazy stuff that they didn't see coming.
Totally agree. And you know what? I got to eat the dog food. And I agree that was a real highlight. And I really appreciate you leaning into that bad tactical choice at that moment, because I really did get to appreciate, like, my character design worked, right? And it succeeded in this particular situation. And I was so happy that it got to execute what, you know, the plan was. Let me give you a very brief scene from Friday night. And if anybody knows the Volturnus campaign, the best session we've had, they're in the artifact. And they get to this last room, they beat the guards. In the last room, there's a centuries-old brain suspended in a tank with fluid, with ancient machines pumping fluid and wires going into it and all that kind of stuff. And it's basically just an enemy that they're not supposed to interact with. And one of my players, or my friend Andre, who's playing a medic there, goes, are the tubes accessible? Can we grab onto the tubes? And I go, you can pull out the tubes, you can break them, whatever you want. And he goes, can I inject the truth serum that I have on my sheet into the tube and have that go into the brain? And afterwards, he said, I really enjoyed, Dan, the look of abject horror on your face when you realized what you had just permitted.
It's great. It's great. Yeah.
And they got a whole bunch of information I didn't expect to give them. It was a fascinating moment that they had to play through. And they had a tool. They had a power I was not thinking about that totally broke the expected mystery. And I just gave it to him, and it was one of our favorite moments. So yep. I got to, within the last week, I got to experience both sides of that. More information is probably always better. More informed choices for the players to fight through is fantastic. And absolutely just letting them break an encounter. You will have many more encounters. Just let them break it if that's what they've done.
Yep. Yep, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. I enjoyed the like coming around the hang on, I'll put this image up, right? So coming around the around the stalactite to the rope bridge across with the catapults aimed at you, even though it seemed like Max had clearly encountered this, or I don't know how Max already knew about this one. I've only ever seen it in this module.
I will confess, he also excerpted that encounter into our DCC campaign. So I will confess, I did actually already play through that particular thing. It is no less terrifying. It's one of the most maniacal encounters that's ever been invented. Big props to Sparks for making this, because I played through it twice and I have been absolutely terrified both freaking times.
Yeah, so I enjoyed, you know, chucking boulders at you. I think I even off the cuff increased the number of catapults so that I could fling boulders at you faster. But then when you got to the rope bridge, and this set piece I have run for as boss fight for breakfast multiple times. It's just always delightful. It's such a good set piece. But I did, you got to the rope bridge and you were just like, boom, haste, we rush across the bridge, and I was just like, great. I've seen so many people get gummed up on that bridge so many times, and you just blasted through it. And I was like, that's fantastic. On the other hand, I know I got a little heat for at the end there where it says 5-6. That's where the lever is to bring the boulder down the tunnel. Some folks I know disagreed with my call there that Lauren should have been able to prevent the lever from getting thrown. I think that was just a different visualization of the three-dimensional space. When she came up and backstabbed the guy, I was like, there's still another guy right there next to the lever. Like, why wouldn't he grab and pull it? That's crazy. So I know there was a little disagreement there, but you know, sometimes two different people are just visualizing the 3D space slightly differently, and that's the way it goes.
You know, I've never had a session ever where I didn't feel like I could have done better about something, just for example. Like, and maybe with a communication, right? Maybe with a communication of setting the scene or having a player that disagreed frequently, you know, frequently one of the people that was at the table last weekend. So we do the best we can. We're trying to get, you know, trying to communicate more clearly all the time. So that's part of the social event.
Yep. Dan, we are out of time. Do you have any final thoughts on Jeff Sparks's take on Skull Mount?
I'm so glad you ran it for us, Paul. It's a number. I'm glad I got to play. I've been obsessed by this for these 40 plus years, as absurd as that is. Even more than that, I just like that we got to get together. We get to get together and do an actual play in person is the number one thing. I hope we can do more of that on the channel, or even not on the channel, frankly, if that's what it takes in the future. I think I also kind of want to find out if, like, was there ever a canonical version of Stone Skull Mountain by J. Eric Holmes, or was that just a one-off throwaway illustration? I don't know. So I think I'm going to probably dig into the history a little bit more. Now that I've broached the subject of actually what is the content of Sparks' version, maybe now I'm going to feel free to be a little bit more free with maybe my version or doing more research around that. So I'm glad you finally pulled the Band-Aid off, Paul.
I'll be curious to see if you end up building your own version. I would love to see it. But I also recommend, you know, go grab yourself a copy of Skull Mountain on DriveThruRPG. It's a great module and an absolute steal at whatever their pittance they're asking for over there. So definitely check it out. viewers, if you have your own version of Skull Mountain, or have played Jeff Sparks' version, or have other thoughts about what should exist in Skull Mountain, or Stone Mountain, as it's labeled originally, leave us a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Post it here in the comment section of the YouTube video. We check those out occasionally, and absolutely farm them for future topics for shows down the road. So we'd love to hear from you.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub, places like that. We do have the handle Wandrian DMs on all of those sites. So look for us there and probe the depths of that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also, there's various podcasters such as iTunes, Spotify, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
It really does. And of course, thanks to our patrons who are brilliant and tasteful, who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server, including the weekly after show chat that we'll have in about 10 minutes with our top brain trust of patrons. And if you have other thoughts or experiences with your version of Skull Mountain, we can think about that and maybe improve all of our games. We're back on normally next week. Is that right, Paul?
Yep. Should be.
Fantastic. So with the different schedule last week, I'm like, is there more stuff like that coming up immediately? So please don't forget that we are live every Sunday, one way or another, at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.